picking through the remains of our neighbors' homes, looking for anything salvageable. Later, they asked us to give blood, and I did, despite my reservations. In a room full of my classmates, I lay on the tiny bed while the phlebotomist rubbed iodine on my arm and reassured me that it wouldn't be so bad. Just a little pinch and a burning sensation. And at first it wasn't bad. It was just a little pinch and a burning sensation. But then I looked at my arm, and I saw the blood flowing out of me, and all I wanted was to push it all back into my veins. I tried to panic quietly, but now I felt trapped and terrified. I thought they would let my blood keep draining until I was completely empty. The phlebotomist stopped by and looked at my bag and said, "Well, you're a slow bleeder." I rocked in the bed and tried to keep repeating to myself the details of cellular reproduction, which we'd been learning before the flood. I quizzed myself on the differences between eukaryotes and prokaryotes, and I tried to remember how viruses fit into the picture. I tried not to turn into a virus while I waited. At some point, the phlebotomist freed me, and I vowed never to donate again. But 6 years later, Calvin was in the hospital after taking a terrible beating from someone, and I was lying down again, the blood again swirling out of my arm and into the bags, and soon into my brother's body. Your blood is one of the only things you truly own, and yet they can take it out of you. They can put it in other people. They can combine people in any way they want. Traces of my blood are still inside Calvin today. In another safe town across the country, another boy with a gun and a grudge shot a classroom full of children. He didn't even know them. He'd been dumped by a girl at his high school, and he wanted to prove to her that he was important. He left a note blaming her. He was hoping to set the record for kills, but he'd never fired a gun before, and his aim was poor. 5 people died. 4 were wounded. The safe town is dark now. It is cold and will never feel safe again. In America, we send children to school to get shot and to learn algebra and physics and history and biology and literature. Less civilized nations don't have such an organized system for murdering their children. Mass murders in undeveloped countries occur because they are savages. Mass murders occur in our country because we are self-actualized and recognize the importance of occasional virgin sacrifices. Those other countries have to stage civil wars and conscript the children into the army and keep them high on meth and give them AK-47s. And this system is all around less predictable and not nearly as safe for the adults. They need famine and poverty to slowly choke children to death rather than humanely shooting them at their desks. They need predator drones dispatched by a nation significantly more advanced in child killing. American children know someday they may grow up to be good guys, and once that occurs, they will want to live in a world in which good guys are still capable of stopping bad guys. The children learn how to hide beneath their desks. They spend every morning learning what to do in the case of an active shooter. The students are like bulletproof vests for the rest of society. We only feel unsafe because we're actually safer than anyone else on the planet. Most days, there were rallies downtown. Anti-gun rallies and pro-gun rallies. Rallies to increase awareness and treatment of mental illness. Anti-immigration rallies. Anti-Muslim rallies. There were always crowds shuffling around in the heart of Seldom Falls. A mass of people angry about something and holding signs in the air. Police helicopters hovered overhead. They weren't in a position to do anything. If I'd been mugged, a helicopter would have been useless. On the ground, The police wore riot gear and carried military-grade weaponry that wasn't quite deadly enough for our military anymore. Every now and then, someone would step outside the designated rally boundaries, and they would be tased and then cuffed. Later, they would be released with a fine and a warning. Mayor Randy told us again and again how he had made us safer. A mile away from my house, a SWAT team raided Ken M's house based on an anonymous tip. They fired tear gas into his home and crashed through the windows and abducted him. His young children were terrified. He spent 3 days in jail, but it turned out he'd done nothing wrong. He'd just made a teenager angry on the internet. He'd gotten into a sports argument with a child, and that child had tracked down his personal details and then called the police, saying he had credible evidence the man was a terrorist, stashing IEDs and other deadly weapons. The town paid to replace Ken's windows. 2 weeks later, that same teenager called the SWAT team again, and there was another standoff. Renee texted to say she had to see me, so I drove to her apartment. She poured us both tea, and then told me she had a confession. She'd been one of the tabloid leaks after my arrest. "Okay," I said. "This is when you're supposed to forgive me." "I don't." "To tell you the truth," Renee said, "when they showed that picture of you on the news, I wasn't surprised. I thought it could have been you." She leaned forward and blew on her tea. It was as if she were talking about the weather, rather than telling me she thought I might be a mass murderer. "It wasn't me." I know, she said. "I'm just saying." I agreed to go shopping for fabrics with Renee. She was still one of the few people in Seldom Falls who wasn't afraid to be seen with me in public. Renee liked fabrics and yarns and glitters. She owned more varieties of candles than I'd ever seen. They were arranged in her house in such volume and with such precision that it looked like she was staging an occult ritual. I don't know why she wanted me to go with her, because I'm not interested in crafting. Maybe she just felt safer with another woman by her side. Even before her divorce, she was anxious about being alone in public. As we walked down the yarn aisle, she told me about a recent assault on a woman. Most of Renee's information came from social media. "She was with her kids," she said, "walking past a church, and some Mexicans just grabbed her and raped her in the back of a van and dropped her in a park." The villains in Renee's stories were generally Mexican. If there were any Mexicans in our town, I had never seen them. Everyone knew to be afraid, but didn't know whom to be afraid of. When the threat is ambiguous, you need to personalize it. It's not healthy to be afraid of the atmosphere itself, so you need to find the one who is poisoning it. Renee spent so much time being afraid of the strangers, but we all would have been much safer if we'd spent more time fearing the people who looked just like us. "Someone found her unconscious in the morning," Renee said, "and obviously her kids are traumatized forever." She picked up two balls of yarn, one red and one a little more red, and weighed them in her hands. We entered an aisle full of dozens of types of feathers. Renee was somehow able to distinguish the different uses for each one. I was once told I was allergic to feathers, but I've never trusted doctors' diagnoses. Allergies are our way of rejecting nature. Renee periodically scanned the store. I knew she was checking for emergency exits, because I was doing the same thing. Our cart was filled with trinkets and baubles and so many different kinds of glitter. "Are we here for something specific?" I said. "Would you rather be somewhere else?" She shook a bag of gemstones next to her ear like a maraca, listening for I don't know what. "Do you have something better to do?" "Don't you?" I made Renee stop at the liquor store on the way back to her house. She didn't drink anymore. She wasn't officially in any recovery program, but in her mid-twenties, she woke up in a strange bed and had no idea how she'd gotten there. She'd blacked out half the weekends of her young adult life. She'd been robbed twice, men leaving with her purse while she slept off a dozen tequila shots. She was afraid of the person she used to be. I poured Canadian Club into my tea. "Do you miss working?" I said. She had quit a few months ago and was trying to stretch her money out to live simply. "Did you know 40% of all deaths occur on the job?" "That doesn't sound true." "Have you looked it up? I've looked it up." She piled scrapbooking materials on her coffee table. "You can stay if you want, but I have work to do," she said. I refilled my mug. I stayed at Renee's place for 2 days. She had plenty of food, her TV worked, and she had a high-speed internet connection. We didn't talk much. When Robbie texted, I told him I needed a few days away. I didn't like feeling needed. I wanted nobody to want me for anything. Renee was busy cutting perfect circles and making precise folds in paper, and then gluing things to other things. I was on her computer, searching for information on guns. "What is the best gun?" I searched. There was no clear answer. There are best guns for picking off varmints, and best guns for home protection, and best guns for stopping a black bear dead in its tracks, and best guns for taking down enemy aircraft, and best guns for enacting your childhood fantasies, and best guns for getting the government off your back. I spent hours reading everything I could. "Do I need a gun?" I searched. By the next morning, I'd received several emails advertising great deals on guns. Subject lines like, "Ensure your safety." "Want to be safe? A dose of sanity in an insane world." Ads in the margins now promoted great deals. "Don't forget the ammo. The most powerful weapon on the market." On the morning of the second day, there was a box outside Renee's door, addressed to me. It contained 50 bullets. Free samples. "Feel the power in your hands." I hadn't typed Renee's address anywhere. Someone knew what I was searching and where I was, and there was nothing I could do about it. "Pull the trigger on your freedom." There was a flyer advertising a gun and knife expo. "Kill or be killed." It was all very simple. I could see the appeal. Every time you type something, someone else can see it. Every thought you share with your computer is shared with the government or with a hacker. They made computers indispensable, convinced us we all needed them to survive. And then after we bought them and bought upgrades to them, they told us our computers were the most dangerous things in our homes. So they started monitoring us. It was for our own good. The only way to stay safe was to allow them in so they could see everything everyone was thinking at all times. Privacy is a commodity with so many conditions attached that your warranty is invalid by the time you open the box. But the boy who did the shooting had a computer, and they didn't find him. They didn't stop him. So they needed more access. A congressman had proposed a bill allowing government agents to remotely access any computer on U.S. soil without a search warrant. Random morality checks. If you're not a bad guy, then you don't have anything to worry about. All you're doing is sacrificing a little bit of privacy for the greater good. I was not interested in being a good guy. I was even less interested in being a good girl. Good guys get to be aggressive. Good girls have to be quiet and submissive and do as they're told. Good guys get to be the heroes. Good girls get to cook dinner for the heroes and wash their dishes afterward. Good guys get blowjobs. Good girls give them. Good guys carry guns and feel safe and are surrounded by a force field of good guyness. Good girls have to wait around for someone to save them. On the walk home from Renee's house, a man in a suit and a $30 haircut approached me. He was wearing a wedding ring. He put his hand on my arm without my permission. He was bigger than me. He looked strong enough to jimmy open a window or kick down a dead-bolted door. He said, "I want you to know, you are beautiful." When a man says a thing to you, you're supposed to smile and thank him for including you in his thoughts. It was morning, and people were walking past us on their way to work. His hand was still on my arm. I felt like a fish flopping around on the deck of a boat, the fisherman deciding whether to keep me or throw me back, deciding whether he should swing me around and crush my brains against the side of the boat so he could descale me and fillet me and serve me inside a taco. He leaned down closer to me and said, "I want to make you an offer." His breath smelled like old hot dogs, like he'd eaten hot dogs for breakfast, like he was a man who would eat hot dogs for breakfast and then grab the arms of women on the street. "I'll give you $50 if you let me take a picture of you." I squirmed away. I hated that it could be described as squirming, that even my evasive tactics felt childish. "You don't have to get naked or anything. I just want to remember what you look like right now." I shook my head. There were words I wanted to say, but they wouldn't line up in order in my mouth. "Don't be such a bitch," he said, touching my arm again, harder this time. "It's like an art thing. I'm not asking you to show me your tits." Arms crossed over my chest, head down. I hustled away from him. Maybe people thought I was his wife and we were having a normal argument. Maybe they thought I was a prostitute. Maybe they didn't care. If he wanted to, he could pick me up, throw me over his shoulder and take me back to his house. He could lock me in his basement and chain me to the water heater. "Fine, $100, he said. "That's fair. You don't even have to do anything." Everyone could use $100. Between unemployment and my savings, I had about 4 months before I was in serious trouble. Letting a strange man take a clothed picture of me would take seconds, and it would be easy. But then he would own my body. He would have it on his phone and carry me in his pocket. He would look at it whenever he was bored, and I would have to appear in his mind and do terrible things with him. One day, his wife would find pictures of me and dozens of other women in his phone. He would tell her he had to do things like this because she didn't do anything to make him feel sexy anymore. She would feel guilty. I got to the intersection at Main and Magnolia. Rush hour traffic sped by. He stood behind me, his hands on my hips like we were in the audience at a concert. "Last offer. $250, but you have to take your shirt off." I felt his erection against my lower back. I swung my elbows wildly, and when he released his grip, I sprinted out into traffic. Part of me wanted to get hit. Part of me wanted him to see me broken and bleeding in the street and know it was his fault. Cars honked, and I swerved and dodged, and I kept running. And he stood on the other side of the street yelling, "I didn't want to see your fat ass naked anyway." Women do not own their bodies. Men take pictures of us when we are not looking. They surreptitiously record videos of our legs on the bus and load them to the internet, where other men can stare at our legs and masturbate. We wore a dress that day because it was hot outside, because it made us feel good about ourselves, because we had a date, because we felt entitled to dress however we liked. They gather in groups on corners and follow us home with their eyes. They leave the residue of their vision on our bodies. They tell us they love women because they love their mother and their sister and their daughter. I should have taken the money. It would have been reparations for the way men have treated my body since I was 13, when my gym teacher, Mr. Gagne, called me into his office to tell me he could see my nipples through my shirt, and I should start wearing a bra, or he might get the wrong message. Every time a man meets a woman, he should have to give her $5. He should have to give her $5 and say, "I'm sorry." Then he should never talk again. One day late in August, a confession booth appeared on the corner near my favorite bar. Nobody knew who had put it there, but there were lines to get in. I went to the bar and sat where I could see through the window, waiting for someone to exit the booth. I would follow them home and see what they were doing with everyone's secrets. I staked the booth out every day for a week, 12 hours a day. I never saw anybody leave, not even to go to the bathroom. Finally, I decided to go myself. Nobody made eye contact while we waited in line. When it was my turn, I asked the person on the other side of the screen who she was, but she wouldn't tell me. She didn't say anything about Jesus or any other God. She said, "Tell me your sins." And I told her. I needed someone to know. I won't tell you what I confessed that time. That's between me and whatever God you believe in. She listened and absolved me and told me to make my penance by calling my brother. I hadn't even told her I had a brother. Before I'd learned of Calvin's existence, I'd felt I had a pretty good understanding of how things worked. I was never a happy child. My mother used to describe me as somber. But things made sense. After that morning when I found out about my brother, my vision doubled and cracked and doubled again. There is too much truth in the world for children to process. Adults should always lie to children. Children deserve the luxury of not really knowing their parents. They should only find out much later that they are the product of two foul-tempered and unreliable people who had no business running their own lives, let alone another's. My mother's spitefulness and my father's indifference and their casual cruelty to the brother I'd never even met were completely disorienting. I was knocked off my axis. In my dreams, I saw my brother, the one I'd never met. I saw my father reaching into my chest like God, yanking out Adam's rib, and creating this new person. I stopped sleeping. I avoided my parents during the day, and they made very little effort to find me. Their energy was devoted to hating each other. I created dozens of hiding spots around the house and in the yard. When I realized they didn't even notice my absence, I started stealing sips of my father's beer, first to get in trouble, and then, when still nobody noticed, to feel so imbalanced that the world made some kind of sense. After Calvin was born, he and his mother were kicked out of their house. Her father, my father's friend, had disowned her and told her he would treat her as a trespasser if she ever came back. She spent the next few years staying with friends and getting arrested for taking recreational drugs. I was old enough to be aware of things like this, but not really to understand them. I had friends with older sisters who knew her and gossiped about her. One day, when I was 12 years old, she showed up at our door, with a suitcase and the boy who was my half-brother. I had never met him before, though sometimes my mother would slow the car down and point him out. I was the only one home when this girl knocked on my door. "This is Luther," she said. "He's going to stay here a while." I'd thought becoming a mother would turn someone old, but she still looked very young. I let him in and poured him a glass of milk. He didn't say anything. He wasn't crying, but he looked afraid. I tried to tell him jokes, but I didn't know what 5-year-olds would find funny. I turned on the TV for him, and then tried to figure out how to explain this to my mother when she came home. I thought she would throw both of us into the street. I thought she would fly into a rage so intense you could see it from space. Instead, when she opened the door and saw an abandoned boy, she figured it out without asking any questions. She calmly collected his things and then lifted him up, carrying him upstairs to my bedroom. She'd shown him more love in the moment when she met him than she'd shown anyone in years. Later, she made him change his name. "Luther is not an appropriate name," she said, and she erased the past that had followed him through the door. It took him months to respond to Calvin, but soon we all forgot he ever had his name changed. Calvin slept in my bed, and I was moved to a mattress on the floor. This was the arrangement until I moved to college. For the first 2 weeks, he cried. Children love their mothers even if their mothers don't love them. It's a structural defect. It's one of the best arguments against intelligent design. At night, while he cried in my bed, I would lie on the floor and tell him terrible things. I told him his mom had left him because he was a bad child. I told him we were going to cook and eat him. I told him there were bugs so small he couldn't even see them, and they were all over the walls, and at night they would crawl into his ears and lay eggs. I told him he was actually my pet, and I even put the leash on him one night. It was cruel. I was 12 and I'd lost my bed. 2 years later, his mother moved to another city and enrolled in high school as a junior under a fake name. They arrested her before she had a chance to graduate again. There was a time when it was possible to move away to a new city and assume a new identity, and nobody would ever know. Now you're stuck with who you are. There are too many cameras. Everything you do is recorded. She started trying heavier drugs, and all we know is she spent a few years alternating between rehab and jail. She got sober for a while, and even got a job cleaning houses. But she eventually overdosed in the bathroom of a rich person's house. I found out when I saw my father crying in the dark after reading her obituary. I don't know when or how Calvin learned about it. I called my brother because I'd promised I would check in with him once a month, and I didn't want to risk him showing up at my front door if I waited any longer.
"Hey, big sister," he said. "I thought maybe you disappeared."
"I wouldn't even know how to disappear," I said. In the background, I heard his children screaming. I knew so little about them, I couldn't even tell their screams apart. "If it's not a good time, I can call back later."
"They're just chasing the dog," he said. "Did I tell you we got a dog?"
I thought his wife was allergic to dogs. I asked him how things were. He told me about the dog, childhood milestones, a promotion at work. "Just look how fucking normal you are," I said. "Isn't it weird?"
"Normal is good. I like normal."
"Next time I call, you're going to be installing a picket fence and trying to sell me Girl Scout cookies." Normally, our calls were a half hour long. I was nearly finished with my first glass of wine. So either this call had been going faster than I thought, or I was drinking too quickly. He said something to his kids. I wasn't sure if he could even hear me over them. There was a brief debate on his end. I refilled my glass, knowing he could hear me opening the fridge and twisting the cap off the bottle. If he asked what I was doing, I would tell him I'd started drinking bottled water because of the lead in the public water. Or I would tell him I was getting ready to cook a meal. He'd always wanted to teach me how to cook, so he would like that lie. Harmless lies are the glue that keeps families together. "Did you ever own a gun?" I said.
"I have two."
"Even with the kids there?"
"I got them for protection."
"Tell me I don't need a gun. Tell me it's a bad idea."
"Shit, Anna. It's a terrible idea." When I was 13, I found an unloaded shotgun in my father's closet. I was too young to be afraid of it, so I dragged it out of the room, and my mother laughed. "What?" she said to my father. "You're going to kill yourself now?" She took the gun away from me and tossed it to him. "Or you're going to kill me? Jesus Christ, Henry, get a grip." He said nothing. She turned to me. "Your father has big ideas but lacks conviction." He put the gun on the floor and went outside for a long walk. 3 airplanes had gone missing in 1 week. On TV, they guessed that the Russians were responsible, but the Russian president said nothing. The simplest explanation was that those planes had been destroyed, because in some way their existence had inconvenienced a nation-state with too many missiles and not enough restraint. For a week, politicians in our country threatened war. But then 9 people were killed in 1 night in Chicago, and 6 in St. Louis, and 14 in Lansing. It was the middle of summer. People in the heart of the country were slaughtering one another. They said the heat made people more likely to kill. It was a good reminder of how simple we are as animals. When it's hot, we kill. When it's cold, we buy sweaters. Every now and then, someone from a forgotten country will plant a homemade bomb somewhere and remind everyone they exist. Most bombs are just the result of people trying to remind the world of their existence. Men do not have a language for loneliness, so they turn to violence and sports in that order. They cannot cry, so they blow things up instead. September. Other schools in the state had already begun classes, but our high school still hadn't reopened. A group of victims' parents said it should never open again, but should instead stand as a memorial to those who had died. An activist group wanted it to be bulldozed and replaced with a memory garden. Renee thought the only way to heal would be to return the children to the school and proceed as normal. Robbie kept saying he wished everything could just be reset. Mayor Randy said it was important that we not give the shooter what he wanted. But he already had what he wanted. He already had our bodies and our minds. He already had his face on TV and his manifesto read by millions. For a while, there had been nightly vigils. Parents and friends came to the school, hoping to find answers to questions they never thought they'd ask. They'd hoped to see something they could never see again. But now we were being told to heal. We were being told that this must not define us. In the interim, anyone could visit the site. People placed flowers and candles and other mementos in the grass next to the cafeteria. Teddy bears, weathered and filthy, sat heaped along the wall of the gym. Someone had spray-painted on the wall, "Still, we survive." Nobody had ever confiscated my keys when I was suspended. So one night I let myself in and walked the ghost-filled halls. I can see ghosts because I nearly died once when I was 17, and again when I was 20. The first time I flipped my mother's car speeding around a curve. A stranger pulled me out of the wreck, and I spent 2 weeks in the hospital. I needed months of physical therapy to learn how to walk normally again. The second time, I was thrown down a flight of stairs by a jealous college boyfriend. He said he didn't think I would actually fall. He was just trying to scare me. He was upset because I'd been talking to another guy in my class. He convinced me not to press charges, because he was already on probation from some minor drug offenses and one more strike would ruin his life. He said he was sorry. He said, "You just made me so mad." When I tried to break up with him after that, he threatened to kill himself. We stayed together another 6 months. I only left him when he proposed to me, and my survival instincts forced me to run. Even before the shooting, there had been 2 ghosts in the school. The football player who suffered a freak injury on the field and died in the gym. And the geometry teacher,
who choked on an almond in front of his students. But now the halls were bustling. Some of the bodies had lain there for 2 days during the investigation. Professional cleaners had tried to buff the blood out of the floors, but if you looked, you could still see the stains. The first ghost I recognized was Todd F., the freshman boy who had become the face of the news coverage. He was tiny, so tiny it was hard to believe he was even in high school. His glasses were too big for his face. His backpack so overstuffed with books, it looked like he was carrying an even tinier person on his back. They said Todd had been shot in the leg and was dragging himself along the hallway while the shooter followed and taunted him. Todd mumbled a prayer, and the shooter said, "I'm your god now." They say Todd kept the shooter distracted while others ran to safety. Todd's ghost did not look heroic. He looked like a boy running late for class. He paced between his locker and the old chem lab, which had been ravaged in the attack. Broken glass littered the floors. Powerful solvents had spilled and eaten holes into desks. Bullet holes pocked the walls like acne scars. The teacher's desk was flipped on its side, so students could shelter behind it. Todd passed through me, and my memory flashed to the moments just before the shooting, to Todd rushing out of the classroom, feeling sick and lonely, like he'd just somehow embarrassed himself in front of a group of girls. He was so wrapped up in his own teenage anxiety that he hadn't even noticed the alarms. In my old classroom, my replacement's paperwork was still spread across the desk, ruined by the sprinklers that had been activated by the explosions. A couple windows were broken, but mostly it looked like my room. I imagine my room repopulated with surly boys in the back scribbling on the desktops, earnest boys in the front raising their hands, distracted and vain girls checking their reflections in their phones and waiting for someone online to validate them, nerdy girls embracing their unpopularity and trying to engage with the work, even a few boys craning their necks to try to see up my skirt as I sat on my desk with my legs crossed. I was doing my job, and I was useful. Sometime in the future, when they were lamenting their lost youth, they would talk about my class. Some of them would remember how they'd been moved by a particular novel. They would laugh at the time I threw a copy of Brave New World at a sleeping boy's head. They would remember how much they hated my class and me, and reading and words. The day I was suspended, Hank T. called me into his office and told me, "You are not an easy person to employ." I was in trouble because none of my students had done the assigned reading. I was in trouble because I told them that people who don't do the reading are statistically 3 times more likely to end up in jail. And when one of the boys rolled his eyes at me, I told him I wished his eyes would roll out the back of his head so I could stomp on them and grind them into the floor. And when he snickered at me with that disdainful teenage boy face of his, I took his bag from under his desk and threw it out the window. Hank T. said things like this made me an unstable presence, a liability. He said, "I know you think the students love you, but they don't." "I was too unpredictable," he said. "If a teacher's biggest crime is being too interesting, then that teacher should be rewarded and not fired." There had been complaints, probably from students who had failed, comments about how my grades were arbitrary and unfair, suggestions that I'd picked on certain students and played favorites, but everyone has favorites. Neutrality and objectivity don't exist. Some people are just afraid of owning their beliefs. There were questions about why some days we didn't have a plan. But not having a plan is a plan. Had no one ever watched a movie about a teacher? Had no one ever been inspired before? I figured out who some of the complainers were, and I sent them messages online. But that only made things worse. Hank asked me to leave, and I said I would, but that I deserved more warning than this.
You've gotten plenty of warnings, he said. I was being fired, though I didn't realize it until later. On my way out, I kicked over his trash can and turned out the lights in his office. Someone keyed his car in the parking lot, and they blamed me for that, too. I needed to go out and see someone. So I called Robbie, and then I called Renee, and then I called Angie. None of them answered. When you need people, there are no people near you. When you don't need them, they surround you and smother you. I remembered being 12 years old and wanting urgently to get away from the little brother who had broken my family, and locking myself in my bedroom. But he sat on the other side of the door, crying, begging me to let him in. I left him out there for hours, trying to read a book, trying to just be a person by myself. When he stopped crying, I still saw his shadow under the door. I heard his sniffling breath. I felt his presence still crowding into my room. And soon my mother was banging on the door, demanding I let him in. And then my father was there too, drill in hand. They removed my bedroom door and never replaced it. My father said I no longer deserved door privileges. When I was a teacher, I used to feel guilty about going to happy hour after work and then emerging, four drinks later, into a sunlit afternoon, while people in business clothes rushed home and overachieving moms walked to the gym, and dads rode bikes down the street with their children. I used to worry that some parent would recognize me, and I would have to explain my choice to be drunk midday. My justification then was that I had no responsibilities to tend to at home. But in small towns, people get reputations, and I did not want a reputation. Now, with the sun gone and our circadian rhythms disrupted, nobody judged you for ordering a shot and a beer at noon on a Monday. My favorite bar, across the street from the confession booth, was called Murphy's Law. It was owned by a retired cop named Murphy, who had heard the phrase but didn't know what it meant. It was a half mile from the school. It used to be a mile away, but the gravitational pull of the mass murder had drawn everything closer to the hub. Everything in town had contracted and tightened like atoms in winter. The sandwich board sign on the sidewalk said, "The place where good friends meet." I needed a good friend, and I went there most days ready to meet one. As a teenager, I had four good friends. We dressed alike, and we made one another laugh, and we spent afternoons drawing pictures of our teachers doing terrible things to one another in the lounge. We discussed strategies for meeting boys, and what to do with them if we were alone, how to avoid getting pregnant. We watched movies about women falling in love with men who refused to take no for an answer. We listened to music and danced. We smoked pot and lied to one another. We talked about all the things we hated about ourselves, our faces and our arms and our hair and our butts and our personalities. One of those girls is dead. She was stabbed by an ex-boyfriend who'd been stalking her. The second friend still lives in Seldom Falls, but we haven't spoken in over a decade. When we see each other in public, we don't even say hello anymore. The third friend works for a company in Seattle that sells cute magnets with pithy sayings on them about weight loss and about Mondays being a particularly bad day of the week. The last one moved away to college and disappeared so completely from my life that I've sometimes wondered whether she even existed at all. Most of the regulars at Murphy's Law have lived in this town their whole lives and had lost their jobs in the recession. Seldom Falls had once been one of the country's leading manufacturers of elevator parts. We had a massive factory by the lake. Everybody worked there, building buttons, pulleys, gears. But factories die, and nobody realized this. And there is no such thing as reincarnation. There was no compelling reason for Seldom Falls to continue existing, except that it was already full of people, and so everyone got a little shabbier each year. They grew up in one world, and then found themselves suddenly dying in another. The man next to me was overweight, and the way he groaned when he sat, it sounded like he'd been walking for days. His name was Brady. He'd worked at least a dozen different jobs around town, and had always been friendly enough to me. If you live in a place like Seldom Falls long enough, you recognize everyone. It allows you to trick yourself into believing you really know them. Brady had a beard so thick, it looked like there might not even be skin beneath it. Like, if he shaved, there would just be no face at all. His lips were the color of Mountain Dew, and his hands shook as he waited for his first drink. He knew who I was, but was polite enough not to mention it. He was here like I was, because there was no compelling reason to be somewhere else. The TVs above the bar were tuned to the news with the sound off and the captions on. He looked like he needed a good friend.
"You ever think there's too many bones?" Brady said. "We have 206 bones. That's way too many things to break."
I hadn't thought of it, but he was right.
"I know you need your bones," he said. "Don't get me wrong. I thank the good Lord for all the bones I do have. It's just, why not a few less?"
"I broke my femur once," I told him. That wasn't true. I had broken bones before, but never that one. It just seemed like the most dramatic bone to break.
"Shit. Shit, shit, shit."
He motioned to the bartender for a refill.
"How old were you?"
16.
"What kind of fucking world is it where 16-year-olds can break their fucking femurs? You have to go to rehab?"
I told him I did. I told him it had been grueling. He buried his face in his hands. I stood to reassure him that I was fine now. I did a little hip-shaking dance move. I decided not to tell him that when I was 16, a boy in my high school pinned me against my locker and reached up my skirt and forced his fingers inside me while his friends watched and called me a slut. I didn't think he would be able to handle that. He clinked his glass against mine. He was in the habit of glass clinking as a sort of punctuation.
"Here's to working femurs," he said.
"Here's to being able to run away," I replied. All the seats in the bar had filled. The jukebox played songs about the South and songs about guitars and songs about sex. On the news, they were talking about a celebrity whose nude pictures had been stolen from her phone. The scrolling ticker said most of the world's polar bears were dead. It said someone in Atlanta had shot 9 people at a carnival. I was out of money, but Brady said he'd cover me. It was possible I was permanently out of money. I didn't know. They wouldn't accept my card. I was supposed to be applying for jobs.
"One thing they don't talk about on the news," Brady said, "is the gangs."
I said I supposed he was right again, though it seemed to me that some days all they talked about on TV was gangs. Why else would I know the names of the major street gangs in Chicago? Why else would I know what MS-13 was? There was profit in convincing us that gangs ran the cities and soon they would be here. The farther away you move from the rest of the world, the more paranoid you are about them eventually catching up to you.
"The gangs, when you get in their way, you know what they do? They don't kill you. They cut off your tongue to send a message, or they cut off your balls and nail them to your front door."
I was happy, I said, not to have balls then. I asked him how he'd learned so much about gangs, and he said he'd watched a couple specials on TV. "I don't think I've ever seen a gang," I said.
"Well, they're not here yet."
In the papers, they were saying crime was actually down across the country, but Brady said that was a lie. It was just to keep people from panicking. I told him I'd been thinking about a bomb shelter.
"You think a gang can't get inside a bomb shelter?" he said. "Gangs do whatever they want."
"So what are you going to do?" He chugged half a pint.
"With any luck, I'll be dead long before they show up," he said.
A man had been eavesdropping on our conversation. He shared his own theories about creeping death. He said things were much different when he was a kid. He said he couldn't believe what had happened to his country.
We used to not even lock our doors, he said.
We used to not even lock our doors. People always said this. The world wasn't safe when we were young, but it felt safe. Maybe we should have been locking doors. I remember being young and wishing I could lock my door. I remember not even having a door. When I got home from the bar, I found an envelope from Calvin. He'd written a short note saying he was thinking about me. Harlan had drawn a series of scribbles and circles meant to represent me and him standing under the sun. Children love people because they're told to love them, and they don't know how to do anything else. They draw pictures for adults because it's all they have to offer. Victims, Part 2. Karina R. transferred to our school in sixth grade. Her family had recently moved from Warsaw, and though she spoke excellent English, she was bullied mercilessly for her accent. She sat next to me in classes and got in the habit of writing notes to me on her own legs. She would hike her skirt up and write on her thigh in marker, "I hate this place." At first, I thought the notes were private, like a living diary. One day she wrote, "Everybody here is ugly," and handed me the marker and presented her thigh to me. "They're dumb, too," I wrote, and she laughed. For the next 2 months, we covered each other's skin in notes, first surreptitiously in class and later in her bedroom, riding up and down each other's arms and legs and bellies. The marker says it's permanent, but if you scrub hard enough, it goes away. And so we felt free to expose the darkest thoughts we had, before washing them off and starting over the next day. It was the most intimate experience of my life. But soon she became popular, because she would steal vodka from her parents and get drunk with the boys in the woods. And then she got a 16-year-old boyfriend. By the end of the year, she'd begun spreading rumors that I was a lesbian. If we'd been boys, I would have just fought her. Instead, I internalized all the hatred and scorn and let it fester. Karina moved away years ago, but her younger brother still lived here and was working maintenance at the school when the shooter arrived. He was wounded, losing the use of his right arm. I wanted to visit him in the hospital and leave a note on his arm while he slept. But I was afraid people would see me. Kelsey P. was a mediocre student, but a pretty good artist, who I always figured would end up in advertising someday, living in New York City and saying things like, "I cannot believe I used to live in a place where you can't get Thai food after midnight." The first bullet entered through her right eye, and the second bullet ripped through her lung. They said she might survive, but they didn't know what kind of life she might live. Sue G. lived four houses away and only came outside occasionally to yell at the neighborhood children to stop touching her fence. It was a white vinyl fence, and it had cost her a lot of money, she said. And when they laughed at her, she lectured them about the rising costs of oil, and if anyone really pushed her, she started on problems with the Arabs. She had lived there as long as I could remember, since I was a teenager at least. "You think I don't know your parents?" she yelled, pointlessly. "You think I don't know everybody?" Just the act of knowing people was a threat. She had collected secrets. Early afternoon, there were more packages on her doorstep. Sometimes they got delivered to me by accident. Sometimes I opened them. Often they were fish tank accessories or fish-related products, like a pillow that looked like a trout, or a wall sign that featured a bass saying, "Who you callin' Big Mouth?" Some people like fish. I sometimes delivered them to her door and pretended the box had been sliced open before I received it. She never invited me in, but, peering over her shoulder, I saw junk piled up to the ceilings. She had to carve a path through the piles just to navigate her own house. It smelled terrible, like the sawdust a school janitor throws on a puddle of vomit. It was like her house was slowly digesting her. Her son Michael was a cop, the kind of casually corrupt one who would demand free food at the deli and flash his lights just to blow through stop signs. He was on the scene at the school, and he took 2 bullets to the leg. But he would survive. He would have to retire from the force and live on disability in his mother's garbage-filled house. After he moved in, I heard her screaming at him many nights as he dragged lumpy black bags out to the curb. Overnight, she sneaked out and ransacked her own trash. Alex A. was wise beyond his years, but only by a few days. He spent most of his time hanging around the movie theater, drinking vodka and Sprite from a large soda cup. He was 20 when he finally graduated from high school, and years later, most of his friends were still high school students. He had a steady supply of pot and a small apartment where they could listen to psychedelic rock and hide from their parents. When I was 15, I had a 29-year-old boyfriend named Miles, who was just like Alex. We sat in his sad apartment while he spun records and lectured me on music history, telling me why this band or that band is particularly important. Sometimes I brought Calvin with me, and Miles kept him entertained with video games and candy. I'd sworn Calvin to secrecy about what happened in that apartment. Miles taught me how to roll joints, and he drove me places when I wanted to be driven to places. I felt very mature. We had aggressively mediocre sex, though I didn't realize at the time it could be better than that. Whenever I saw Alex A. standing outside McDonald's with a high school girl staring up at him as if he were so wise, I was embarrassed to feel a pang of wistfulness. I don't miss being a teenager, but I miss that naive feeling of having discovered something the rest of the world is too dumb to have figured out. Alex was there on the day of the shooting, working for a plumber called in to repair a leaking toilet. For 2 months, his post outside the theater was abandoned. And then one day, he was there again, leaning on a cane, his right leg heavily bandaged, a divot in his head where he'd lost some of the bone. Lily F.'s father had once won a morning radio contest by eating one of the host's toenail clippings on the air. He'd done this to earn a $25 gift card and a life-size replica of a famous cartoon panda, posed in the midst of a jump kick. The replica was placed in the center of the family's front lawn. Lily F.'s father spent his evenings cleaning it, decorating it for upcoming holidays, a party hat for New Year's, bunny ears for Easter, beads for Mardi Gras. I'd heard from a neighbor that his wife hated that he devoted so much energy to maintaining a movie prop. But it was a strange bit of whimsy I enjoyed. It made me feel like I was living in a place with interesting people. After the shooting, he dressed the panda in a black kimono and surrounded it with photos of his daughter. The panda has been in mourning ever since. Kareem D. had a mother who was friendly, but unstable. Everyone in town recognized her. When I was a teenager, before Kareem was ever born, I saw her walking all over Seldom Falls, sometimes 10 miles in a day. She was a decade older than me, but looked 3 times that. One of her legs was slightly shorter than the other, so her stride was lopsided, but surprisingly fast. She always carried a tote bag over her right shoulder. Later, I learned that she sometimes found stray animals and put them in the bag to carry them to shelters. She covered so much ground, I thought she might be a ghost. When I was 17, my parents took me and my brother to an orchard 30 miles outside town. It was meant to be a bonding experience, an all-American apple-picking event. And while my parents bickered afterward about what we were going to do with 15 pounds of apples, I swear I saw her Kareem's eventual mother, looking into her bag and talking to something.